You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find these episodes encouraging.
As Beth said, we are in a series in the book of Luke. We're looking at, through the lens of the book of Luke, Jesus and the marginalized. I said at the very beginning that Matthew, Mark and Luke have a specific lens. John has quite a different lens if you're to frame the Gospels. The Gospel of John is all about Jesus and God and me. It has that I'm in relationship with God focus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's very much like what's going on in the world. We're in the book of Luke at chapter 19. Story of, I'm going to say some clues, see if you can get them. They are a tax collector. You might, if you've been around church, you might be able to get this. They're a tax collector. Anyone guess it? They are particularly short. It is Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, the shortest man in the Bible. Except for Nehemiah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joe, for actually laughing there. Yeah. I sensed some laughers, so I'm just going to claim it. We're in Luke chapter 19, verses 1 to 10. Pull out your devices if that's how you'd like to follow along. It'll be on the screen as well. Do we have anyone who would like to read it? I have it written here. You can copy straight off. Would anyone like to read it so you don't get sick of my voice? Any takers? Thanks, Chris. Everyone, this is Chris. Woo! Thank you.
So, Luke 19, verse 1 to 10. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was. But because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed the sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here, and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." I was going to say I could relate with Zacchaeus at the beginning when he couldn't see over the crowd because I'm also short.
Are you also a tax collector? No. That is indeed the story of Zacchaeus, little man, famous in children's storybooks. We're going through this series on Luke, and let me give you an update on where we're up to so far in the book. We're at Luke 19, and Jesus has his eyes fixed on Jerusalem. In a couple of chapters, he's going to die. Spoiler alert, that's around the track. He rises again, but right now he's on his way. And Jesus has accumulated this huge crowd of followers, and they are freaking loving it. They are obsessed with Jesus. There's some people who aren't, namely the religious leaders, the scribes, the Romans. They're not big fans, but most of the crowd are absolutely on board with Jesus. And so chapter after chapter, Jesus comes along and he heals the blind, bam, and the people all say, "Yay! This is wonderful. We like this Jesus." Next, he heals a lady with a disability who has had a disability for 18 years, hunched over. Yay, we like this Jesus. This Jesus is absolutely wonderful. He feeds the crowds. Their response is, "Yay, bam, bam." Say the words, "Yay." Yay, we love this Jesus. He heals a man who had been born with, who had been demon possessed. And what did they say? Yay. 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 Thank you. Hordes of people. Jesus has been gathering these crowds, whipping them up. He's quite a good orator. He's a good speaker. He tells them all these stories. He tells them stories about how even if they try a little bit, and they may not be wonderfully powerful, strong, wealthy people, but even if they try a little bit, that can still have a really big impact in the world. That's a nice story, isn't it? That's a nice idea. And all the people say, yay, we love these Jesus. He tells these parables that place the lowly at the center of God's plan. These stories that are confusing for those on the outside, but those on the inside, they get it. They're like, oh, I have a place in the kingdom of God. I have a place in the story of salvation. I have a place in the story of God. And they all say, yay, it's wonderful, wonderful news. Up until this point in the book, everyone loves Jesus except those little religious elite who unfortunately will kill him, but everybody else loves Jesus. We get to this chapter, and in verse 7, all the people begin to mutter. That's a bad sign. That's a bad sign. It kind of feels like he's been on this electoral drive. Is anyone following US politics at the moment? Yeah, we're obsessed. It's almost as like he's been on this big electoral drive and then he really puts his foot in it and there's a blunder. It makes me think of, like when Tony Abbott ate an onion. Yeah. Do you remember that? Yeah, yeah. And it was like, ooh, that backfired. Or like when Tony Abbott called Kevin Rudd, said that Kevin Rudd was not a suppository of all wisdom. It's glorious, isn't it? Actually, a lot of things that Tony Abbott said. Sorry to get political. Just felt like blunders along the route where he suddenly lost all these followers. Jesus is in that moment. He farted at the party. And people are like, oh yeah, we're not sure if we can be on board with this Jesus guy anymore. Everyone is yelling, yay, we love it when Jesus goes to the margins. Keep it up, doing such good work. Keep healing, keep feeding us, keep looking after the margins. And then Jesus ends up at a margin where they're all like, nay, this is not a margin I'm on board with. I wonder, what margin are you not on board with? There's got to be something. What margin are you like, oh, I would really like it if I got to heaven and that person was not there. Let's be honest. Like you have those people, I have those people that we're like, ah, I'd like to draw a line here. The balloon has popped, followers are falling off the wagon because Jesus went a little bit too far to the margins. And that's where we are today with our friend Zacchaeus, the sinner. And I think this is probably where, if I know our church, and I think I know our church, this is where most of us are going to struggle most in the book of Luke. This is where we're going to be uncomfortable. So if you haven't listened to the rest of the series yet, I want you to put it all in context. There is a lot of love going on. There's a lot of goodness. I also want to put it in the context of this flowing out of a relationship that is healing and holy and sacred. It's not just you got to work harder. So I want to put it all in that context. But in this passage, the problem is the poor are poor not by choice. They have been brought into this world under certain circumstances and they are working hard, but they're struggling to get above it. And so when Jesus comes along and he says something like equality, he doesn't use that word, but that concept that comes out through Matthew, Mark, and Luke, everyone loves it. The people who are blind, they aren't blind by choice. They have a visual impairment. And so when Jesus comes along and he heals them, people are on board with that. When Jesus comes along and he heals the woman with her disability, she's been cast to the margins because of something entirely outside of her control. That's why she's on the margins. And so people love it when Jesus heals her. But a tax collector, on the other hand, is on the margins because of something that he has done. And something that he has done very deliberately. If we were to couch it in our terms that we often speak about in church, he has committed the sin of greed. He has been greedy. He has accumulated. If we place it in kind of more progressive language, he has committed the sin of oppression. He is oppressing other people. He's a traitor. He's the bad guy. He is on the margins because no one wants anything to do with him. Can we take a moment to look at what tax collectors were like? Let's do that. Because I think that might help make sense of a few things. Context. Context is always important when we're reading the Bible. Rome has invaded, and across Israel, the Roman Empire are forcing down their might. They are forcing people to obey the Empire at whatever cost. They're like the Galactic Empire in Star Wars. They're there, and they're atrocious in the way that they treat the Jewish people. They also tax the Jewish people. They've done this right across Europe at this point. They also tax the Jewish people, and they claim huge amounts of tax from them. So if you're a farmer, if you're a potter, if you're a goods trader, you are taxed at a really exorbitant rate by the Roman Empire. Now, when it came to gathering taxes, for most taxes, the Roman Empire would send their own people. They would send their own forces in order to gather the taxes. But on occasions, they needed someone who knew the local customs. They needed someone who could speak the local language. They knew someone who was able to look at Rachel and Alyssa and say, "I know about how much you make, and so I know how much I'm going to tax you. I know how much my cousins earn because I've lived with them for decades. And so I know how much is reasonable for the Roman Empire to be taxing. I know what 25% is." And that's where the tax collectors came in. They were Jewish people. They were people who had family amongst the Jewish nation. And they would go out to their friends, their fellow countrymen, and they would work on behalf of the Roman Empire to collect the taxes. The Roman Empire didn't pay them particularly well. It just gave them authority, and so they would take a cut on top of it. So if the Roman Empire charged 25%, I would take 30%, and I would keep that 5% for myself, never mind the fact that you're my grandmother. That's a tax collector situation. Now, just to put it in context, Jewish law at the moment, at the time, outside of scripture, like knowing the Jewish law at the time, tax collectors were in the same boat as robbers. So they were like, they were just painted with the same brush. If a tax collector offered money at the synagogue or the temple, it was refused because it was assumed that that money had been gained by illicit means. A tax collector wasn't allowed to be a judge in the legal system, and they weren't even allowed to give evidence in the legal system because nobody trusted them. In fact, the family of a tax collector was not allowed to give evidence in that judicial system. Do you get the point? No one likes the tax collectors. Bad, bad. Zacchaeus is not just any tax collector. Does anyone see what he's described as in the passage? He's a chief tax collector. Bow, bow. Do we see why we don't like Zacchaeus now? Zacchaeus has gone around to each of us and has stabbed us in the back something fierce and betrayed us to the ones who have invaded. Not how you make friends, yeah? Zacchaeus is the bad guy here. I always found the phrase, love your enemy, which Jesus is famous for, love your enemy, I always found that phrase really easy, if I'm honest. I found it particularly easy because I discovered I really didn't have any enemies. Growing up, everyone who was around me was really lovely to me. They were good people. The people who were in my life, my parents, my siblings, yeah, they got annoying. One time, my brothers, they had one of these slinky toys where a tennis ball was on the end of a big elastic string, and they pulled it back and they told me, Joel, hang out at the other end of this. We're going to let it go. We can put a bucket on your head for safety. And they let it go and it went through the bucket, smashed the bucket, and ended in my face. My brothers, bless them, I still loved them. Not because I was a good person, let's be clear, but because I didn't really see them as my enemy. I didn't feel like I had, and anyone who was supposed to be my enemy was very distant. They were on the news somewhere. Often it was framed in the Middle East and on the news reporting that I was seeing, but they were just a very distant, distant concept. And when somebody is distant, they're very easy to love. Of course I love them. I never met them, but I love them. I discovered what enemy meant for me when I came out, and people started slandering, people started kicking me out of places, people started taking away my rights. And at that point, I got very angry. I got very, very angry. And for me, it festered. And I tried to move through it, but there were plenty of times where I would walk into a room and I'd be like, I'm talking to you and you and you and you and you can screw yourself. And that would be how I would exist, because suddenly I discovered, there is enmity in the world. There is pain and there is hurt. At that point, loving your enemy was no longer a tick that I had achieved. It became something that I probably just didn't want to do. That's like that. That's just my honest assessment of where I was at. Despite Zacchaeus's flaws, let's call it, he has a number of flaws, being short is not one of his flaws, but Jesus decides to do what? Decides to have dinner with him. Now, here's not what happens. Here is not what happens. It doesn't go, Zacchaeus sees Jesus, Zacchaeus repents of his wrongdoing, and then Jesus has a meal with Zacchaeus. That's not the order of events. The order of events is that Jesus sees Zacchaeus, recognizes who he is, knows that he is despised, and he says, Zacchaeus, I must have lunch with you today. A little bit presumptive on the part of Jesus, not quite socially acceptable to say, I'm coming to your place, but nevertheless, Jesus goes ahead with it. And by the end of the meal, something has shifted. On your pieces of paper, on the left, I want you to draw a picture of yourself. It needs to be accurate. I jest. It doesn't have to be accurate. It doesn't have to be accurate at all. A stick figure will do. I want you to draw a picture of you. If you don't feel like doing it, you don't have to at all. But it's just a little activity to keep us thinking. I want you to draw yourself on the left, and on the right, I want you to draw your enemy. Now, you might sit there and be like, I don't think I really have an enemy. You're like me at that time in my life. You're like, I kind of love everyone. That's okay. Just draw a stick figure, and maybe your enemy can be, I don't know, like robbery. Like it can be something abstract. But just draw a stick figure that represents, and I want you to have in your head, if there is somebody that you're like, I really struggle with this person, I want you just to represent them somehow. You don't have to name them. In fact, it's probably best that you don't put that down on paper. Okay, has everyone done that? Now, if you're up for it, I want you to draw a dining table between yourself and your enemy. Draw a dining table, and you can put your favorite food on the dining table if you'd like. Chicken and chips is Thomas's favorite. If Thomas is your enemy, come chat to me later. Draw a dining table. I have a question. You don't have to answer this, but maybe like a show of hands. Who, when I said, draw your enemy, who had someone or a group of people pop to mind fairly quickly? About 2/3 of people. Yeah, yeah, yep. A couple of people like, yeah, it was really quick. Yep. I think it's very natural for us to have what we would describe as enemies, people who see the world differently to us, people who perhaps have harmed us, or a lot of the time, people who have harmed people that we love. They become even more viscerally our enemies. So you've all got this dining table between you and your friend, frenemy, let's call them. And let's keep going. You can ignore your piece of paper for now, but you've got that there. Zacchaeus somehow along the line changes. There is a wonderful transformation that takes place in this instance. And the words are, I'm going to, what does he say? I've got to find it. He says, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. So half of what Zacchaeus owns, he immediately gives away. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Now, either he cheated everybody many, many times, and hopefully they're dead because he can't give that money back now, or he is going to be utterly destitute at this point. Because if he is going to pay back four times the amount, he's just given away everything that he owns. Presumably, he also has a family that he needs to take. The idea is, this is a complete overhaul of Zacchaeus's way of seeing the world. This is a complete overhaul of how Zacchaeus relates to himself, relates to the people of Israel, relates to Jesus. It's fundamentally shifted, and Jesus says these words. He says, salvation has come to this house. Salvation has come to this house. Now, I want to pause on that word just for a moment, because I think that is a word that is thrown around Christianity a huge amount and is often wildly misunderstood. Here's my hot take that is not particularly hot. I don't think when Jesus says salvation has come to this house, I don't think that what has happened is that Zacchaeus has just stepped from eternal death in hell into eternal life in heaven. I don't think that is what salvation means in that context. In other places of the Bible, it can be interpreted that way well and truly. But in the book of Luke, the word salvation is used in quite a specific way. And it's not as broad as it often is. The word salvation in Luke, it often refers to an evening of justice, an equalization that takes place. A salvation in the book of Luke looks like somebody who has been held down by something stepping into something that is not oppressive. A Nigerian theologian, Effiong Udo, he says this. I should give context. Udo tracked the notion of salvation throughout the book of Luke and how that idea has impacted human rights in Nigeria. This is what he says. Luke shows salvation as deliverance from all kinds of oppressive systems, including political and economic. This salvation belongs to all. Thus, no one should be discriminated against on the basis of gender, one's place of birth, or one's station in life. That's Luke theology coming through. Luke shows that in the midst of violence, exploitation, deprivation, the disciples of Jesus can bring hope. The liberating God in the person of Jesus Christ has intervened in that hopeless situation and restored human rights and dignity. God's mighty acts in Luke's Palestine give us hope and enable us to work for a just world, a world of equality, liberation, justice, and peace. That's Luke's theology of salvation. Now, in John, in Hebrews, in Galatians, salvation is quite a different concept. But when we come to Luke and theology, this is what it looks like. Remember we said there is that vertical that takes place between us and God, and then there's this horizontal that takes place. That's what is unfolding here. Now, here's a dilemma that I want to throw out. It feels like it's getting harder and harder to bridge divides in society. It feels like it's getting harder and harder to bridge divides in society. Does anyone else feel that? Yep. Can we throw out our theories onto why that might be the case? Can we throw out ideas that don't have to be right as to why that might be the case? I see Chris's hand up. I'm going to run to you with a microphone so that people online can hear.
I was going to give a quick one. The internet, unfortunately, it can be used for good, but it can also be used for evil.
Yes. Yeah. Internet can be used for good, can be used for evil.
Thanks. I feel it's because we don't speak with the people we don't like and we don't agree with. Because I feel if we got to speak with them and know them, we'd know, hey, you're actually a human being like me and have fears and dreams. And maybe you went through, like what Beth was saying, you went through all this shit stuff when you were growing up. And that's why you're like that. You know, if I went through the same, I'd be as bad as you or 10 times worse. So I think we don't speak with them and therefore we don't have the opportunity to have built understanding.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
I think just to connect to what Chris and Walter said, I think it's the internet which is allowing us to live in a world where we don't need to actually bridge those divides. Like, we can find our communities that share our exact values and that provide us with an echo chamber, essentially, to make us feel good. You don't actually need to bridge divides anymore because you have your own community that you can find online or you can find in a much more accessible way than maybe you could 50 years ago. Yeah.
Echo chambers feel so good.
Similar to that, I think that we have our own echo chambers as well. Like, I've lived in Surrey Hills or Darlinghurst or Inner West, like, the whole time I've lived in Sydney, which is half my life. So there's so many people that are like-minded to me and like-hearted. And I look at, like, the recent referendum, I was genuinely shocked that that happened because everyone I know had the same beliefs as me. So I think we can get a little naive just because we're sticking in our own group of people.
Yeah. Thanks, Tali. Any other thoughts? Does anyone disagree? Does anyone think it's getting easier? Nope. Okay. I would 100% agree on each of those diagnoses. I think it is getting harder and harder because we have these echo chambers that pop up and that we feed into, call it the algorithm, call it human nature, they exist. If you have your phone, type into Google this person's name, Deyah Khan, D-E-E-Y-A-H space Khan, K-H-A-N, Deyah Khan. She has I think I've spoken about her before here. She has a documentary called White Right. She is a Palestinian-Iranian woman who grew up in Norway and faced racism all her life. D-R-D-E-E-Y-A-H space Khan, K-H-A-N. She's a documentary maker, and she embarked on a documentary to understand white extremism. And the way that she did it was she went and she met with extremists across, in this context, the United States. She went and she got to know them. She met them in their houses. She had dinner with them over weeks and months. She built relationships with them. You can now watch that documentary on YouTube. It's available and it is abso-frickin-lutely incredible. She built these relationships. There's one point in that documentary where a hard far right-wing neo-Nazi gets to the point where he says, oh yeah, I don't want Muslims out of this country anymore because I count you as a friend. Prior to that, he'd never met a Muslim. And it's an extraordinarily powerful documentary of her building these bridges. Christians are not particularly well known for building those bridges. Let's just call that. So if you're newish to church, I hope that you haven't come here with the expectation that we're going to be wonderful. we are finding our way in this context. One of the things that I think we as a church, as New City Church, need to sit with as we think through how we do relating to those people who are on the other side of the boundaries, on the margins that are there because of things that we hold viscerally dear, is think through how we do that safely, how we do that in community. And so I'm going to be upfront. There are situations which are abusive and which are unsafe, in which case you need to tap out. But I hope that as a community, we are aiming to be in a space where we are healing, where we are growing, such that there is a goal that we will be able to sit across the table from those that we don't see eye to eye to and have a transformative encounter, have a transformative encounter. And here's one concept that I want us to think through when it comes to Zacchaeus. The people began to mutter. They went from yay to oh no, 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 because they saw Zacchaeus and they had a category for him. Let's call it a label. They had a label that they had slapped on Zacchaeus, and that label was sinner. That label was, you are a sinner. Here is a sociological theory that we teach in social work. It's called uncreatively labeling theory. It's typically used in childhood and adolescent incarceration theory. That's where we would often speak about it. The initial deviance takes place. Maybe the kid is caught with some marijuana. Suddenly, that kid has a label, and that label is, you're a deviant, you're a criminal, you're a juvie, you're an offender. Offender gets slapped on them, and that is now the label that they will wear for the rest of their life. Because of that label, now that's really important, because of that label, they then amplify the deviance. So now it's not you're caught with pot, it's caught you're caught with pot and with a weapon on you. And so the deviance is amplified. Now they are needing a weapon because they're unsafe, because they've been labeled with something, but they have self-identified with that label now, such that it's internalized, and so the deviance occurs again and they get caught and they end up back in prison. We call it recidivism. That is a basic theory that social workers will often turn back to say, okay, this is part of how society functions. Let's apply that to Zacchaeus, old mate. Zacchaeus knows that he is a sinner. Zacchaeus knows that he is on the margins. Zacchaeus knows that he has no friends. Zacchaeus knows that his family have turned against him. Zacchaeus turns to the only thing that can support him at this time, finances that he gets by ripping off his family and friends. And so the cycle continues. Sin is vicious. Sin is a label that we slap on each other and it sticks. I'm not going to ask you to do this, but perhaps you can do it as an exercise around that picture that you've drawn on of yourself, that detailed, accurate, beautiful picture of you. What labels have been slapped on you? What labels have you had thrown at you throughout your life? If you have come from church land, sinner is going to be one of those labels that you have slapped on you. Now, in some senses, it's just a truism. You're a sinner. You have committed sin. You have at times stepped out of the way of God. But then it gets amplified and you start to internalize that and you start to believe, oh, that's all I am. Maybe you've been slapped with something along the lines of deviant. Maybe you've been the one who has been slapped with heretic, false apostle, wolf in sheep's clothing. These are all biblical concepts that people slap on us. Maybe you've been caricatured as something once upon a time, and now you're just carrying it over and over and over again. And that label is now something that has been so deeply internalized that you just struggle to separate from it. And you carry it with you everywhere that you go. And so even when you come to a new church and think, I'm going to start fresh, I'm going to try something new, it comes with you because it's not out there anymore. It's now inside of you, and you have believed it so thoroughly. This is the problem with labels. They stick. This is the problem with only seeing somebody through a lens of sinner. But what lens does Jesus bring? In verse 9, he sees Zacchaeus and he says, salvation has come to this house. Why? Because Zacchaeus is a son of Abraham. Not Zacchaeus was a son of Abraham, not it is now, he has now become a son of Abraham. No, from day dot, Zacchaeus was a child of Abraham. After the book of Acts, after a whole lot of stuff has happened in the early church, we can take that phrase, that son of Abraham, and we can broaden it out to say Jews and Gentiles, to say that Jesus looks at you and he says, you, my friend, are no longer whatever it is that they have called you. You are now a child of God. That's your label. That's your label that you can now take upon yourself. The phrase Abraham is particularly powerful because it's blood relative. It is family. You, my friend, are now a child of God. You are now a family in this place. You who have once identified only as the wretched and the poor and the oppressed, those who are out there in the margins, no, you are close, you are in, you are embraced, you are a child of God. So for some of us here, that is the message that just needs to sink in. We need to sit in that and keep repeating it to ourselves and to each other until damn well we believe it. We need to hold on to that truth and not give it up. That is precious. That is the gospel, and we cannot budge from that. That is the grounding of our faith because it is who we are. We are children of the Most High God, and nothing in heaven and on earth and under the earth can ever take that away from us. Nothing that I say, nothing that they say, nothing that you say about yourself, full stop. That feels important, doesn't it? That feels fundamental. When I think about Zacchaeus, that chief tax collector on the margins, I want to say to him, you're a traitor. But Jesus says to him, you're a child of God. Here's my questions. How do we move past these labels? What would it look like if we moved past these labels? What would shift in our own lives and in society if we genuinely saw ourselves and others as children of God? What would shift? Have a look at those questions and think for a moment. Take some deep breaths, if that's helpful for you. Ground yourself and picture that world. Would anyone like to throw out some wisdom on any of those questions? Keegan.
I think a good starting point is just like repeating the opposite of the label and internalizing it. Like, for example, if you believe you are a sinner, you could say, I'm not a sinner, and then like internalize that in being a child of God.
Yeah. Thanks, Keegan. Flip it around. Any other thoughts? Enneagram. Beth.
I'll take it. I heard a quote recently. I'll try and remember it. It was, we reject in others what we cannot accept in ourselves. And that came to mind with the labels, that like if we're putting labels on ourselves and other people, it's like the root of that might be that we have rejected ourselves, and we're like putting that rejection out on others that show that rejection back to us. So if we can see, maybe if we can see ourselves as children of God really, really deeply, that can help that shift to see others also as children of God.
Thanks, Beth.
I think once we accept that there are labels and we recognize them and we can move past them, we begin to believe that we are more than just what the labels portray us as.
We have to see it first before we can undo it. Any other thoughts?
Understanding the difference between labels. So labels are very much man-made. Yeah, so like God doesn't see the labels the way we see the labels.
Yeah. Yep. It's people that have slapped those labels on us. God didn't start with those labels, well and truly. Thank you. Any other? Wonderful. Let me give two concluding thoughts. Is this helpful? I hope this is helpful. This is, I think, foundational to how New City Church has to function. My first thought is, you're sitting there across the dining table with somebody who sees the world in an entirely different way to you. Perhaps you've called them your enemy. Here's what I do as a social worker. I've had plenty of instances where I'm like, wow, you're a jerk, but I have to keep a very professional face here. Here's what I do. I lean in and I say, oh, I hear you. There's the phrase. There's the million-dollar phrase. Oh, I hear you. That doesn't mean I agree with you. I hear, and it also invites them to say more. Oh yeah, I hear you. Maybe practice saying that when somebody says something wildly outrageous. Just say, oh yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And see what happens. Maybe that gives them a chance to explain a little bit more of the way that they see the world, a chance for you to find common ground. For me though, that was just the first little tip that I use. For me though, foundationally, it has to stem out of what Beth was saying. We need to be secure in who we are as children of God before we can go out and bring healing in the name of Jesus. We need to be so grounded in our status as dearly beloved co-heirs of the eternal riches of the kingdom of God before we can face a world that is hurting. Perhaps that means that you need to come into New City and spend time healing before you face those demons of your past. Perhaps it means that you need to come into this space and support one another and carry one another and champion one another, keep reminding each other of the depths of that love before we stick our heads above the parapet. Thomas and I have an out clause for if ever it feels like I am exhausted in my academic work or in advocacy work when it comes to LGBT stuff, when it comes to media stuff, such that I can say, I don't want to do this anymore, and we both agree, that's it, no more. Maybe you need an out clause and share that with somebody who can hold you accountable to that and support you in that. But the goal is never just to stay out. The goal is never to tap out and never step back in again. Perhaps for you at this point, healing feels like a long, long way away. Healing feels like it will never come, such that you will never be able to sit across the table and say to that person, you also are a child of God. Maybe you're at that point. I want to honor that and say, if that's where you're at, that means that you have been very, very hurt. And my prayer for you is that you would find healing, not so that the other person can feel warm and mushy like they're loved. That's not the point of this. The point of this is so that you can feel like you are on a journey towards deeper understanding of your dignity and worth. And maybe on that journey, we will find that we are healed enough that we can combined embrace those people in the margins. Maybe, or maybe not. But we can hope, we can aim, we can heal together.